The Detroit Free Press has called my guest Jack Olson the master of true crime. In his many books about sensational crimes, Olson has explored the mind of the psychopath and the effects of these crimes on families and communities. His books include Give a Boy a Gun and Son, a Psychopath and His Victims. Olson's newest book is Doc, The Rape of the Town of Lovell. Doc is Dr. John Story, the family doctor in a small Wyoming town. In 1985, Story was convicted of raping and assaulting several of his patients. As the story unfolded during his trial, it came out that he may have raped as many as 200 female patients during the 25 years he practiced medicine in Lovell. The revelations about Dr. Story tore the town of Lovell apart. He was one of the most respected citizens, the revered family doctor who had saved the lives of many of the town's residents. It was hard for many people to accept what had been going on behind the closed doors of Dr. Story's examining room. Jack Olson found that Dr. Story performed as many as 8 or 9 pelvic exams a day on female patients. He would recommend pelvic exams for all kinds of medical complaints, such as colds and headaches. It was during these pelvic exams that he committed all kinds of assaults on these women.
He raped patients in his examining room. He fondled patients. He did peculiar things like sometimes exposing himself or coming around to the side of the table and inserting himself between the patient's naked body and the table. Don't ask me what that means, but he did it apparently in several cases. But primarily, he was guilty of what you might call surreptitious entry during pelvic exams, when he would have the woman lying on her back, expecting to be poked and probed anyway, and wishing she were anywhere but there, like most women when they're getting a pelvic. He would he'd either just flat out do it, or if he felt there might be a problem, he would say, "Well, I'm having trouble seeing what I need to see. I'm going to have to dilate you." Or he would say, "I have to use the tube." Those were kind of the key phrases that told what he was really up to.
Many of the women talked about him saying to them before the examination, "My, but you look pretty today." A kind of, I suppose, a friendly flirtation, which I guess from a doctor could be just a nice thing to say. But many of them also report that during the examinations, he was trying to hurt them, or they were hurt.
There isn't any question that he was sadistic about it. You can imagine far beyond what I wrote in my book, because I underplayed everything. It was a horrible enough story as it was, but he was very clearly enjoying hurting people. Women would go to Dr. Story for a pelvic, women that had been going to him since infancy and knew no other doctor, and they would go home after the pelvic and not be able to have normal sex with their husbands for 2 or 3 weeks. There are women in Lovell today who still find sex painful, not because of his pelvics, but because of the way he sewed them up after deliveries. Let your mind wander about what that means. Maybe it was just accidental. But there's a whole pattern of inflicting pain, women just in excruciating pain, because they didn't know that a pelvic isn't supposed to hurt.
You mentioned this before, but the position that a woman is in during a pelvic examination, I think it is one of the more vulnerable positions that women feel. And the doctor, I guess because a woman is flat on her back with her feet in the stirrups, a doctor can get a sense of their own omnipotence. Surely she cannot go anywhere. Was he interested in really that power position over women?
I think that's almost entirely what he was interested in. First of all, Dr. Story did not like Mormons. His residency was spent in Utah, where he encountered Mormons for the first time, and I confirmed this with his wife and other people. He came home frothing at the mouth about Mormon doctrine. He himself was an extremely conservative Bible Christian who founded his own church because the Baptist church was too liberal for him. And now winds up in this little town of Lovell, which was more than half Mormon. More than half his patients were Mormon. And so he couldn't come out and publicly assault the Mormons. And I think that he developed this technique of getting even with the Mormons, whom he despised, by raping their women.
Now, he didn't do this to all his female patients. How did he pick and choose, I suppose?
He picked and chose very carefully He picked vulnerable women. He picked women whose marriages were in trouble. He picked women whose husbands were wimps. He picked women who were alone. He picked retarded women in some cases, going down to a retarded child, a woman who was involved in a butane inhalation thing and almost died and had temporary brain damage. He raped her soon after that. Any woman that he felt was very, very shy, which most of the Mormon women are. They certainly don't talk about sex. On the other hand, conversely, he would be very scrupulous in his attention to the undersheriff's wife, the state senator's wife, the mayor's wife, power figures. And as a result, when this all came out, those were the people who jumped in and said, Dr. Story could not have done this. I can tell you from my own experience that he, you know, et cetera.
Why did certain women continue to come back to see him over time, knowing how painful these examinations were, knowing that many of them felt very strange afterward, felt that they had been violated in some kind of way but didn't completely understand it? Why come back to a doctor who's going to hurt you?
Well, that's three or four different things. The women who realized what he was doing, in some cases they actually saw him. In most cases they didn't. When they realized what he was doing, for the most part, they left and they did not come back. And in many cases they reported him, although nothing came of it. Those who allowed him to inflict this pain over and over again were the women who didn't know any better. They thought this is what a pelvic was. You go in and you, et cetera, et cetera. And it hurts.
I'm speaking today with Jack Olson. His book is called Doc, The Rape of the Town of Lovell, and it's published by Athenaeum. You talked to a female, I believe she was a detective, Judy Cashel, and she was working on this case, and she said about the women of Lovell, Wyoming, that they were shy and naive and, quote, the 20th century had passed them by. She seemed to talk about a real, what we might call sexual illiteracy, that many women didn't know, for instance, what an erect penis looked like.
One of the victims has a master's degree from the University of Utah and spelled penis, P-E-N-U-S, when she wrote a letter to the medical board. Sex is not one of the most popular subjects in any small town culture, but particularly among the Mormons, it is not talked about. They frown on sex education. They tried to bring sex education to Lovell, and they just ran the guy out of town within about 5 minutes. But also the Baptists and the Lutherans and the Methodists in Lovell, Wyoming, for the most part, did not talk about sex. Dr. Story, when he was a child in Maxwell, Nebraska, a town of 400, did not talk about sex. And I'm not a psychologist, but I think that that sort of sexual repression, I think it makes sex into a glamorous, mysterious, alluring thing that it wouldn't be if they did talk about it and come out in the open. But I'm not really qualified to make that conclusion.
Well, it could also make sex into something rather scary.
And rather weird. And it evidently did in this case.
You had said that others had reported what Dr. Story had done, but there were several women, actually, that went public with this story. Who were these women?
Well, after 20 years of this reign of sexual terror, a woman named Arden MacArthur, a very strong Mormon, head of her relief society in her own Mormon ward, finally had enough. She had been one of Dr. Story's biggest backers. She had been his apologist for years. Women would say, Dr. Story makes me wait for 2 hours in the waiting room. And Arden would say, a good doctor is worth waiting for. Arden would deliver hot cross buns to his house. Arden would do his laundry. As the Mormons do these acts, whether you're Mormon or not, and this was part of her good deeds. She thought Dr. Story was the greatest thing alive, and they would have long talks about religion. He would try to convert her, and she would try to convert him, et cetera, et cetera. One day, her daughter Minda came home and said, Mom, I think Dr. Story did something to me today that he shouldn't have done. Now, understand, these women didn't say things like, Dr. Story raped me, Dr. Story inserted. That isn't the way that, it's just he did something. He did something, Mom.
And something sexual, though.
Well, that was connoted, but they didn't want to talk about it. Jumping ahead of myself here a little bit, Arden MacArthur did not know what was done to her two daughters until she read my book. She only knew that he had done something. She didn't want to hear about it. So she told Minda in this first instance, Minda, Dr. Story has delivered some of your brothers and sisters. He's delivered your babies. Dr. Story loves you. He saved Dad's life, etc., etc. Minda goes back home thinking, well, there must be something wrong with me. What is it that makes me think that Dr. Story was inserting himself into me? Then it happened again. And again, Arden said, come on, you're hallucinating, you're imagining things. Then it happened to another daughter of Arden MacArthur. And finally, Arden got it through her head what was happening. And she did a 180-degree flip-flop. She called the medical board. She raised hell with everybody. But still was put off by these people. They didn't want to fool with the town's number one establishment figure. The medical board said, okay, we'll do it if you bring us five victims.
And she was able to get more than five victims.
After an awful lot of work, because when she started, she thought it's Meg and Minda, that's it. That's key to this whole situation, that each woman thought she was the only victim. It turned out there were women all over town, but they didn't know it. One woman said to me, you want to know who the victims were? Stand outside the Mormon church on Sunday and watch the women coming out. They were the victims, without hardly any exceptions. But Arden, when she started trying to find the necessary five, the magic number five, didn't know where to start.
How did Dr. Story deny the allegations, which he did?
Well, he denied the allegations totally, and he still does, and his wife does, and his daughters do, and his hardcore supporters do. He's gone through several explanations for how this could have happened. The current one is that the Mormon Church conspired to ruin him because he started his own church, his own competitive church in Lovell, and because he wouldn't convert to the Mormon church. Now, this flies in the face of all the reality. In the first place, it wasn't all Mormons, although it was primarily. There were Lutheran women. There were he apparently violated quite a few Mexican-American women early in the game who were Catholics. There was a Presbyterian woman. And moreover, when the case broke, and it finally became a criminal matter rather than just a license revocation matter, women started checking in from all over the country who had lived in Lovell. One was in Maine, one was in Arizona, one was in Utah, one was in Colorado, getting in touch with the county attorney and saying, yeah, he did it to me 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. Then we, little by little began to see the whole picture. I think there were probably 100 to 200 victims. That's a heck of a conspiracy.
What kind of a witness was Dr. Story on the stand?
He wasn't a very effective witness for himself. People who saw him on 60 Minutes felt the same way, that he's not a very expressive person. He always had difficulty communicating. His patients would misunderstand. And he's very autocratic. His favorite comment to his patients whenever they asked him any kind of question was, I'm the doctor here. And he controlled everything, which is characteristic of rapists.
The women charged that they had been sexually assaulted. You used the word rape. Now, he denied that this happened, and yet there must be some reason why someone would do this to women. As you look into his past, what would be something that would make someone want to abuse women
like
this?
If you looked into his past, you'd think you were looking at a Norman Rockwell cover for the old Saturday Evening Post. Little Nebraska town, the Platte River just down the road. What I saw, which seems to me to be common to a lot of these cases, was one very eccentric parent and one very indulgent parent, which is not to say that they were not fine people. You had a father who was, to say the least, odd. And a very lovely mother who was still alive, who wrote three different letters to the judge explaining that her son had to be innocent, who testified for her son. She's now in her 80s, a very lovely person, but quite clearly her son John can do no wrong.
But an odd parent is not going to make a psychopath.
Nobody knows what makes a psychopath. But I have found in several cases that I've been involved in, the combination of an eccentric parent who sends out eccentric signals. You know, the first signals that we get as little kids are the ones that determine what we're going to be, whether we form a conscience, etc. So the combination of the eccentric parent and the indulgent parents, if your parents approve of everything that you do, you don't develop a conscience either. I mean, we're talking highly theoretical stuff here, but there seems to be a connection.
What kind of messages, though, would his father send out? What kind of eccentric messages?
His father was, for example, would march them in the front yard with wooden rifles in a kind of not a Nazi style, but a kind of an autocratic sort of thing. He also would do odd things, like when the family would go to visit, he would sit out in the car and read the stock market reports. He was entirely involved in the family business, which was a general store in this little town, and just known around town as a very fine man, but an odd duck. His mother, as I say, was just a lovely lady, but John can do no wrong.
You say this is the rape of the town of Lovell, Wyoming. How did he rape the town?
Well, the town is split right down the middle and has been ever since this happened. He raped the town, first of all, by raping the women. Second of all, by using this doctor-patient bonding that takes place where your doctor can do no wrong to accumulate a hardcore of supporters who have moved heaven and earth to get him out of prison. In fact, it took 3 years to put him in prison because whenever something would happen to him in the courts or the state system, he would bounce back. Everybody would put the yellow ribbons up on his trees and bring the food over, and Doc Story would be back in business. In fact, on one of those occasions, women who wanted to show their respect and admiration for him called in and set up pelvic exams that they didn't need, just to show how much they trusted good old Doc. Well, that's a rape of the mind. I mean, these people were completely confused by what he did, and he abused this doctor-patient thing. There are still people there who will fight you if you have the nerve to say that Dr. Story is guilty. And if you look into their cases, as I did, you find invariably he saved their lives, or he saved Dad's life, or Mom's life. There's the bonding, and that's what's taken place.
I don't want to beat this thing to the ground, but I would think that the rape of a woman is very different than the rape of a town that is, in a way, complicit with what he was doing. And a woman who, for a variety of different reasons, is there sort of prostrate on a table, that's a different kind of,
yes,
of rape.
Well, it's a slight play on words, but I suppose I could have called it the destruction of a town or the violation of a town's trust, but to me, in a way, that's a rape. If you walk up and down the main street of Lovell nowadays, half the stores are boarded up, and the reason is that when this happened, the town split 50-50, and you had to say where you stood. Families were broken up. Husbands and wives were broken up over this. Every single shop or store in town lost half its customers.
I wonder, with things like true crime, and you write true crime stories, whether it isn't rather like the local evening news where you see murders and fires, and you can say to yourself, well, thank God it's not me. I mean, I can sleep well tonight because it happened to somebody else.
Used to be like that. True crime, with the exception of In Cold Blood, which is a whole another four-hour program that we could talk about, with the exception of In Cold Blood, up until a few years ago, true crime books were blood and guts books, and you read them because you liked violence and you liked to read about the man being slammed into the wall with a fist and the blood flying all over. That's changing, and it's been changing markedly over the last two or three years.
In what way, then?
In the way that the reviewers, for example, are insisting that you also give us some help on understanding why did this murderer become a murderer? Why did this rapist become a rapist? It has now reached the point where if you don't do that, and I've been trying to do that for five books now, if you don't do that, you are taken to task by the reviewers, and that's the way it ought to be. These books cannot be justified in terms of getting people off on violence and rape and murder. The concern is, what made this guy do what he did? What can we learn from it? How can we raise our kids better? How can we avoid being victimized by somebody like this? And there's more and more of that in true crime, and I think that's the reason for the explosion of interest in true crime books these days.
I would think, though, that a certain percent of your readers are going to get off on the violence. I mean, that and reading, even if it is well-documented, well-researched, and well-written, it's there to, I suppose, in a kind of sensational way.
But with a little bit of luck, they'll learn something.
I'm curious about how you choose the stories that you do? And obviously, I suppose part of it is looking at headlines, but there are many headlines about many kinds of violent stories. What makes you choose a particular story? And I guess Doc is a good example.
Well, I seem to have this. The book that I'm working on now is another rape book, and I seem to have fallen into the subject of rape, which is fine with me because I think it's a very important subject. And the reason that I think I have fallen into it is that I have now interviewed probably 30 women who have been raped, and I finally have got it through my stupid masculine skull that this is a very, very cruel crime. Half the women that I talk to can't discuss their rape, which may have happened 20 years ago, without crying. And I finally have got it through my head that this is an important and a dreadful and a horrible crime. So I seem to be writing about it.
I'm interested in as you say, your stupid masculine mind, but what ideas did you have about rape?
I think I probably was a little more enlightened than a lot of people. I'm not stupid, but I didn't realize how horrible it was. I wasn't the extreme that you find with some men. Well, she does it every night with her husband. What's the difference? Or the rapist that I'm now writing about, who, among others in his 55 rapes, raped a lot of prostitutes. And he sits there in the penitentiary telling me how he really didn't mean any harm, et cetera. And he says, with the prostitutes, I was just stealing their time. They did it anyway for money, so I was just stealing their time. And I say, Ed, I don't think you quite understand. But he's a psychopath, and he's never going to understand.
You're talking about understanding rape as a kind of violence and not sex.
Exactly. It's only accidentally a sex crime, you know. It's a crime of hatred, which is what Doc Story was doing. He was ventilating his hatred of the Mormon religion by raping their women. And it's a crime of control and a crime of rage. And sex comes last.
Well, thank you, Jack Olson, for talking with us.
Thank you.